presently housed by Gemini at the June solstice, and Sagittarius and Scorpio in the south, with the Sun presently housed by Sagittarius at the December solstice. The relationship of these two pairs of zodiacal constellations to the Milky Way is not affected by precession and never changes. Gemini and Taurus will always mark the northern gate of the Milky Way, and Sagittarius and Scorpio will always mark the southern gate of the Milky Way. Of the two, however, it is the Sagittarius-Scorpio gate that is the most important, because it so happens that the part of the Milky Way seen through this gate, as we look up at the night sky, forms the very center and heart of our galaxy. Not only that, but because it is the galactic center, in the midst of which astronomers now believe sits an immense black hole, a hyperdense object from which even light cannot escape, there is a notable bulge in precisely this area. Last but not least, in the midst of this so-called nuclear bulge, is another absolutely distinctive feature that astronomers call the Dark Rift, which features prominently in many ancient mythologies, and which is created by a series of overlapping, non-luminous molecular dust clouds. As a result of precession, the December solstice Sun is presently housed by Sagittarius, and thus, as viewed from Earth, targets the galactic center like the bead on the barrel of a rifle. The last time this grand celestial lineup of Earth, December solstice Sun, and the galactic center occurred was a full precessional cycle of 25,920 years ago, and the next time it will happen is a full precessional cycle of 25,920 years in the future. We live, in other words, in a very special, indeed rather unique moment in terms of cosmic and astronomical symbolism. I will elaborate in the next chapter on the symbolic aspect and why the December solstice matters in particular, but first it is important to make something else clear. If, hypothetically, some ancient civilization wished to deploy its knowledge of the regular movements and changes in the heavens in order to draw attention to a particular moment in the flow of time, a possibility that we have considered with the monuments of Giza, then the precessional world ages, while useful, are not really precise enough to spell out an exact date. After all, the broad configurations of each precessional age hold good for 2,160 years. If we want to be more specific than that, then we're going to have to find a celestial event in the period we wish to draw attention to, which is A, an artifact of precession, and B, occurs in a much narrower window than that of a full precessional world age of 2,160 years. Such an event occurs in our time. It is the arrival of the Sun at the December solstice in the southern gate of the Milky Way, between Sagittarius and Scorpio, where it targets the galactic center. There are certain imprecisions, mainly to do with the width of the Sun's disk, and over what period we can say it lines up exactly with the center of the Milky Way when viewed from Earth. But nonetheless, we are not talking about 2,160 years here. The exact targeting of the galactic center occurs in a window that is no more than 80 years wide, and we will continue to be in that window for approximately another 25 years. This creates an interesting situation with regard to the message of Pillar 43 at Göbekli Tepe, because if Paul Burley is right, the reliefs on that pillar use symbolic language to depict the December solstice Sun at the southern gate of the Milky Way between Sagittarius and Scorpio. In other words, those reliefs are speaking to our time. They are speaking to us. Chapter 15, The Place of Creation. As I sit in my hotel room in San Liorfa, in July 2014, spinning the skies on my computer screen, I'm coming more and more to the conclusion that Paul Burley has had a genius insight about the scene on Pillar 43 at Göbekli Tepe. Burley's language in his paper is careful, almost diffident. As we saw in Chapter 14, he says that the Sun figure, a appears to be located accurately on the ecliptic with respect to the familiar constellation of Scorpio. He speaks of other familiar constellations nearby, and he draws our attention to the large bird, the vulture, seemingly holding the sun upon an outstretched wing. He does not say which constellation he believes the vulture represents, but the graphics he includes to reinforce his argument leave no room for doubt that he regards it as an ancient representation of the constellation of Sagittarius. We've already seen that there is evidence for the identification of constellations going far back into the Ice Age, some of which were portrayed in those remote times in forms that are recognizable to us today. From the last chapter, the reader will recall Michael Rappengluck's work on the zodiacal constellation of Taurus, depicted at Lascaux some 17,000 years ago as an aurochs, ancient species of wild cattle, with the six visible stars of the Pleiades on its shoulder. Acknowledging such surprising continuities in the ways that some constellations are depicted does not mean that all the constellations we are familiar with now have always been depicted in the same way by all cultures at all periods of history. This is very far from being the case. Constellations are subject to sometimes radical change, depending on which imaginary figures different cultures choose to project upon the sky. For example, the Mesopotamian constellation of the Bull of Heaven and the modern constellation of Taurus share the Hyades cluster as the head, but in other respects they're very different. Likewise, the Mesopotamian constellation of the Bow and Arrow is built from stars in the constellations that we call Argo and Canis Major, with the star Sirius as the tip of the arrow. The Chinese also have a bow and arrow constellation, built from pretty much the same stars, but the arrow is shorter, with Sirius forming not the tip, but the target. Even when constellation boundaries remain the same from culture to culture, the ways in which those constellations are seen can be very different. Thus, the ancient Egyptians knew the constellation that we call the Great Bear, but represented it as the foreleg of a bull. They saw the Little Bear, Ursa Minor, as a jackal. They depicted the zodiacal constellation of Cancer as a scarab beetle. The constellation of Draco, which we see as a dragon, was figured by the ancient Egyptians as a hippopotamus with a crocodile on its back. There can therefore be no objection in principle to the suggestion that the constellation we call Sagittarius, the archer, and depict as a centaur-man-horse hybrid holding a bow with arrow drawn, could have been seen by the builders of Göbekli Tepe as a vulture with outstretched wings. I spend hours on Stellarium, toggling back and forth between the sky of 9600 BC and the sky of our own epoch, focusing on the region between Sagittarius and Scorpio, the region Burley believes is depicted on Pillar 43, and looking at the relationship of the Sun to these background constellations. The first thing that becomes clear to me is that a vulture with outstretched wings makes a very good figure of Sagittarius. Indeed, it's a much better, more intuitive, and more obvious way to represent the central part of this constellation than the centaur archer that we have inherited from the Mesopotamians and the Greeks. This central part of Sagittarius, minus the centaur's legs and tail, happens to contain its brightest stars and forms an easily recognized asterism, often called the teapot by astronomers today, because it does resemble a modern teapot with a handle, a pointed lid, and a spout. The handle and spout elements, however, could equally effectively be drawn as the outstretched wings of a vulture, while the pointed lid becomes the vulture's neck and head. It's the outstretched wing in front of the vulture, the spout of the teapot, that Burley sees as holding the sun, represented by the prominent disc in the middle of the scene on Pillar 43. But the vulture and the sun are only two aspects of the complex imagery of the pillar. Below and just a little to the right of the vulture is a scorpion. Above and to the right of the vulture is a second large bird, with a long, sickle-shaped beak, and nestled close to this bird is a serpent with a large triangular head, and its body coiled into a curve. A third bird, again with a hooked beak, but smaller, with the look of a chick, is placed below these two figures. again to the right of the vulture, indeed immediately to the right of its extended front wing. Below the scorpion is the head and long neck of a fourth bird. Beside the scorpion, rearing up, is another serpent. Part of the reason for my growing confidence in Burley's conclusion, though he makes little of it in his paper, is that these figures, with only minor adjustments, compare intriguingly with other constellations around the alleged Sagittarius vulture figure. First and foremost, there is the scorpion below and a little to the right of the vulture, which we've seen already has an obvious resemblance to Scorpio, the next constellation along the zodiac from Sagittarius. Its posture and positioning are wrong. We'll look closely into the implications of this in a moment, but it's there, and it is overlapped by the tail end of the constellation that we recognize as Scorpio today. Secondly, there's the large bird above and to the right of the vulture with the curved body of a serpent nestled close to it. These two figures are in the correct position and the correct relationship to one another to match the constellation we call Ophiuchus, the serpent holder, and the serpent constellation, Serpens, that Ophiuchus holds. Thirdly, immediately to the right of the extended front wing of the vulture, there's that other bird, smaller like a chick, with a hooked beak. I email Burley about this and about the different position and orientation of the scorpion on the pillar and the modern constellation of Scorpio, and we arrive, after some back and forth, at a solution. Constellation boundaries, as the reader will recall, are not necessarily drawn in the same place by all cultures at all periods, and it's clear there's been a shift over time in the constellation boundaries here. The chick on pillar 43 appears to have formed a small constellation of its own in the minds of the Göbekli Tepe astronomers, a constellation that utilized some of the important stars today considered to be part of Scorpio. The chick's hooked beak is correctly positioned, and its body is the correct shape, to match the head and claws of Scorpio. Fourthly, beside the scorpion on pillar 43 is a serpent, and beneath the scorpion are the head and long neck of yet another bird, with a headless anthropomorphic figure positioned to its right. The serpent matches the tail of Sagittarius, as we've seen. The vulture appears to be composed from the central part of Sagittarius only, the teapot, so this leaves the remainder of the constellation available to the ancients for other uses. The best contenders for the bird, and for the peculiar little anthropomorphic figure to its right, are parts of the constellations we know today as Pavo and Triangulum Australe. The remainder of Pavo may be involved with further figures present on the pillar to the left of the bird. As is the case with Sagittarius, elements of the modern constellation of Scorpio have been redeployed in the ancient constellations depicted on pillar 43. Only the tail of our Scorpio is in the correct location to match the scorpion on pillar 43, and its head faces to the right, whereas the head of the scorpion on the pillar faces to the left. The scorpion on the pillar is also below the vulture, whereas modern Scorpio is a very large constellation lying parallel and to the right of Sagittarius. I suggest the solution to this problem is that the scorpion on pillar 43 is conjured from a combination of the tail of the modern constellation of Scorpio, right legs of the pillar 43 scorpion, an unused part of the teapot asterism of Sagittarius, right claw of the pillar 43 scorpion, and the constellations that we know as Ara, Telescopium, and Corona Australis, respectively the tail, left legs, and left claw of the pillar 43 scorpion. Meanwhile, as noted above, the claws and head of the modern constellation of Scorpio have been co-opted to form the chick with the hooked beak on pillar 43. This whole issue of the relationship between the modern constellations of Scorpio and Sagittarius and the scorpion and vulture figures depicted on pillar 43 takes on a new level of significance when we remember that in some ancient astronomical figures, Sagittarius is depicted not only as a centaur, a man-horse, but also as a man-horse hybrid with the tail of a scorpion, and sometimes simply as a man-scorpion hybrid. On Babylonian Kuduru stones, often referred to as boundary stones, although it's likely that their function has been misunderstood, a figure of a man-scorpion drawing a bow frequently appears that is universally identified with the archer Sagittarius. What further cements the identification of Sagittarius with the vulture on Pillar 43 is that these man-scorpion figures from the Babylonian Kuduru stones are very often depicted with the legs and feet of birds. Moreover, in some representations, a second scorpion appears beneath the body, in other words, beneath the teapot asterism of Sagittarius, reminiscent of the position of the scorpion on Pillar 43. When all this is taken together, it goes, in my opinion, far beyond anything that can be explained away as mere coincidence. The implication is that ideas of how certain constellations should be depicted that were expressed at Göbekli Tepe almost 12,000 years ago, including the notion that there should be a scorpion in this region of the heavens, were passed down, undergoing some changes in the process, but nonetheless surviving in recognizable form for millennia to find related expression in much later Babylonian astronomical iconography. But given the close connection with ancient Mesopotamia, its antediluvian cities, its seven sages, and its flood survivors washed up in their ark near Göbekli Tepe, we should perhaps not be too surprised. Last but not least, there's the mystery of the three bags or buckets in the upper register of Pillar 43, which caught my eye on my first visit to Göbekli Tepe and which are discussed in Chapter 1. As astronomer Giulio Magli has noticed, these three bags are pretty similar to the three houses in the sky, occurring in the much, very much later, Babylonian Kuduru traditions. What Magli calls the houses in the sky are the symbols of Mesopotamian deities, notably Enlil, who sent the deluge to destroy mankind, and Enki, the god of wisdom, who intervened to save us. The reader will recall from Chapter 8 that it was Enki who warned the patriarch Zisudra of the coming cataclysm and urged him to build the great ark that would ultimately bring the flood survivors to the region of Ararat, so close to Göbekli Tepe. It's hard to avoid the conclusion that all these shared themes in the iconography of Mesopotamia as late as the 1st millennium BC and of Göbekli Tepe as early as the 10th millennium BC have much older antediluvian origins in a lost civilization that was the progenitor of both, and perhaps of many other cultures around the world, and that took pains, through deliberately engineered myths and wisdom traditions, and through carefully structured teachings passed on from generation to generation by initiated sages, to ensure that its memory would not be lost forever from the earth. The Maya. Late into the night, as I work through the whole scenario in my hotel room in San Liurfa, my confidence in Burley's case continues to grow. Once all the surrounding context is taken into account, the vulture holding the sun on its front wing really does look like the figure of an ancient constellation representing the teapot asterism of the constellation of Sagittarius. This then raises the next part of the puzzle. When does the vulture Sagittarius hold the sun? Burley makes clear that he believes the moment represented on Pillar 43 still lay far in the future when Göbekli Tepe was built, indeed 11,600 years in the future, in other words, in our own time, the epoch of 2012. And he comes to this conclusion because it is only in our epoch, specifically in the 80-year window from 1960 to 2040, that the sun on the 21st of December, the winter solstice, not only sits over the outstretched front wing of the bird, in other words, over the spout of the teapot in the modern conception of this asterism, but also targets the nuclear bulge and the dark rift at the center of the Milky Way galaxy. So arguably, this is a very significant astronomical moment that is symbolized on Pillar 43. Very significant indeed, as it turns out, because it is also this exact same 80-year window, where the year 2012 falls just a little after the midpoint, that is signaled in the famous, or perhaps it would now be better to say infamous, Mayan calendar. A great deal of nonsense was talked about that calendar, and particularly about the 21st of December 2012 date,